were talking about the Tampa Bay Lightning and their quest to become the first team to win back-to-back Stanley Cups. In what? There's two teams that have done it in a couple of decades. And I was making the point that for a professional athlete, the idea of winning back-to-back titles and doing so with basically the same group, it's, I think as sports fans and as media, I think we underestimate the specialness of that. And I talked briefly yesterday, it might have been a couple of days ago, about a conversation with Moises Alou, who won a World Series with the 1997 Miami Marlins. I beat the Cleveland Indians, if you remember, in that 4-3 in that series. And a month later, not even a month later, November 11th, I believe, was traded, Moises Alou was traded, to the Houston Astros as part of a multiplayer deal, as the Marlins did, as the Marlins quite often did. They took apart their championship team. And I'm not getting into the financial reasons for it. It was a philosophical thing. It's a just the way they did business. But I remember having a discussion with Moises about the feeling of being moved off a championship team. And that next Marlins team was not going to go on to win the World Series. I don't think anybody necessarily looked at them and thought that they were going to be a repeat champion. But Moises' point was, you know, we celebrated like hell on the field. We celebrated like hell for a couple of weeks after we won the World Series. And then, of course, everybody went their own way, as always happens. And guys kept in touch, but you know, guys went their own way. And I remember Mo saying that he felt as if he'd been denied something by not being able to come back to see that group that he'd won with. I remember him very vividly talking about, you know, just that one day in spring training where not much is going on and you'd sit around the clubhouse and just talk about what you'd gone through last year and sort of the residual enjoyment of being the defending World Series champions and coming back and trying to run it back again. And I've often thought about that. And I was thinking about that last night watching the Lightning celebrate, watching Steven Stamkos carry the cup around and then seeing, you know, Kucherov's post-game comments. And I had no horse in that race, Montreal and Tampa. I really didn't. I would have been happy if Montreal had won. Them losing in 5 games or 7 games didn't really matter to me. The hockey was not, frankly, as enjoyable as I would like my finals to be. But again, that it is what it is. But I really felt an odd sense of happiness, or felt that there was just something right about seeing a team like the Lightning win back-to-back. You know, yes, I know last year was a different Stanley Cup. It was different this year as well. Obviously, the schedule has been completely thrown out of kilter because of COVID-19. But I like the idea of a group that understood, and I think John Cooper made this point, I like the idea of a group that understood that this was probably the last kick at the can for the totality of this group. The core is going to be back, but there are going to be changes around the fringes because it's salary cap league. And I loved, as you watch the Lightning celebrate, that sense of destiny fulfilled. I like seeing a team that is a good team, and the Lightning are a good team. I mean, the Lightning smothered Montreal in that series. As a sports fan, I took a certain amount of satisfaction out of seeing these guys celebrate back-to-back and essentially be able to enjoy it with the same group. Except now, of course, the family and friends are there because they weren't playing in a bubble. So I know there are people out there who are disappointed with the outcome of the series. I know there are people out there who, like me, it was not the best Stanley Cup final I've ever seen. But in a weird sort of way, watching how Tampa celebrated and watching the reaction of John Cooper and, you know, and then kind of digging a little deeper into the salary cap issues this team has to deal with this year, I just think in so many ways, they are a perfect champion for this league. I want to bring in Nick Kypreos, former NHL forward, director of hockey operations for Line Movement. Nick, thank you so much for joining us. Look, I know you won Stanley Cups, but I think I'm right. It's and as I said, I always remember that conversation with Moises because he wasn't whining. He won his, but he just kind of said it'd be nice to. Man, can you imagine doing that with the same guys? And I kind of get that sense when you watch the Lightning that that's what made it extra special.
Well, we all as champions end the game and look at one another, and we can say tomorrow they can break us up. Tomorrow they can trade us. Tomorrow they can send us down to the minors. Tomorrow I may quit and retire, but they will never take this away from us. And that's a constant. I don't care what era you've played in. It's a special feeling to know that 31 teams started this thing at the beginning of the season and only one got to win the final game of the season. And it's so darn hard to win. And when you do, you value each other that much more. And in many ways, until the day you die, you're going to, I haven't won the Stanley Cup in close to 30 years. I watched the celebration, Jeff, last night as if I'm reliving it yesterday. And I get to do it every year. And I even get to watch a World Series or a Euro Cup, a World Cup, a Super Bowl. And one thing's constant, Jeff, is whoever I'm sitting beside watching a championship celebration, I get to tell them that I know exactly how that feels. And when you do it not only once, but twice with a lot of the same guys, and again, I don't care what era you're in for, you're never carrying the same exact team 2 years in a row. It might be one change, two changes, but there are multiple changes. But to win it with the core guys in back-to-back seasons, boy, you really saw it out of the Tampa Bay Lightning last night, what it meant to them. And Kucherov and his comments for his buddy Vasilevsky, and how, like, they're bonded for life.
Nick, what was the biggest difference in this series?
Tampa Bay's a hell of a lot better. That's it.
That's pretty easy.
And in many ways, it's the way it's supposed to work. The team that does it from beginning to end and does it more consistently and does it at a greater level is supposed to win the championship. It doesn't happen all the time. We've known that over the course of history. But last night, it played out the way it should have played out. Tampa is the deeper team. They've done a better job of collecting players, developing players, making key trades, signing free agents, managing their cap. And although, you know, on another day we can argue whether or not, Kucherov coming back and whether they had an $80 or $96 million. I get all of that, and that might be a legitimate conversation for another day. But today, they look at it, and they've done it better than everybody else, including the Montreal Canadiens, and good on them for squeezing every last ounce out of them to get this far. But the better team won, and they deserve to win, and it again played out the way it was supposed to play out.
You know, I looked at the goal scores down the stretch for Tampa. And I mean, their last six goals of the series were scored by Ross Colton, Pat Maroon, Barkley Goodrow, Blake Coleman. I think Tyler Johnson got two. That tells you a lot about the Tampa Bay Lightning, further to your point about them being such a deep team. Because, I mean, Montreal got some good performances out of their depth players. But Tampa got good performances and got goals out of their depth players. And they really did. There was... You watched that game last night, Nick, and it just didn't seem as if there was a break. I mean, it seemed like every line was the fourth line and every line was the first line.
And that tells you, in a salary cap era, how really good Tampa Bay is and will be remembered. And you've also got a guy like Braden Point, who only one other guy in history has scored in consecutive games in the playoffs, and that's Reggie Leach. And yet he doesn't have to score in the Stanley Cup final for them to still win, because of the Coltons, because of the Colemans, because of the Goodrows. And then on the other side, you've got the Montreal Canadiens, who needed Carey Price to score a goal last night because nobody else could. And again, when you factor in that here, that you've got such a balanced attack out of Tampa Bay, and then on the other side, you're asking Cole Caulfield, who's never played an NHL regular season game in his career, to be a go-to guy, will tell you a lack of depth in the Montreal Canadiens lineup last night. Like, there's no scoring out of Gallagher. There's no scoring out of Toffoli. And your biggest threat, your most natural goal-scoring threat out there, is a kid coming out of college who's, you know, barely out of his cafeteria, his on-campus cafeteria. And, again, good on the Montreal Canadiens for squeezing every ounce, but that's not right. That's not supposed to be. That's not the way it's supposed to be to win an NHL championship, when you put on so much pressure on a 21 or 22 year old college kid to score a key goal for you in a Stanley Cup final. That's not the way it should play out, and that's certainly not the way you try to build a championship team.
I mean, I guess the good news for Leafs fans is that the divisions are going to revert to their old format next year, and you're going to have Tampa and Montreal in the same division as you are. Should the Leafs be
Montreal
worried?
May miss the playoffs.
I was going to say that. Should the rest of the division be worried about Montreal?
I think you're gonna have to be ready every night, because you hope that they can hit that level of competitiveness that we saw in the playoffs, but it's not a given, Jeff. And you got to also understand you've let everybody back in the race, including the Florida Panthers, Ottawa Senators, think that they can be a whole lot better. You ask Eugene Melnyk, he's ticked off they missed the playoffs, right? Mm-hmm. He expects a team to be in the playoffs, not compete for the playoffs, be in the playoffs. And then there's the Leafs, and now you factor in the other division in the East, and there's a possibility that with a wild card, five teams can come out of the Metropolitan Division and only three out of the Atlantic. So who's it going to be? Tampa Bay, Boston, and the Leafs, or Tampa Bay, Boston, and Montreal, or Florida? I mean, Someone's getting real disappointed in the Atlantic, who thinks that they can win a Stanley Cup and they're going to miss the playoffs next year.
Now, I understand that there are a bunch of factors here. Obviously, the Seattle Kraken, the draft, there will be trades. We know that Tampa Bay has, in air quotes, salary cap issues. And John Cooper has said, look, this group isn't probably not going to be back together. Probably not the same group. But Tampa's still... You get the impression that they'll still figure out a way to go in the season. They'll probably still be the prohibitive favorites in that division, won't they? Like, we're not seeing a total reworking here, are we?
we got a goalie that went, just won the Conn Smythe that had four shutouts in clinching games and is now regarded the best goalie in the world. That's a pretty good start. You look at that defense with Hedman and McDonough. There's going to be some challenges up front because Coleman and Goodrow's contracts are up. They're going to have to shed some payroll. They know that. And they're going to celebrate the next few days and not worry about it. But, yeah, they're going to be weaker. But I don't know how much weaker when you still factor in Braden Point. Stamkos doesn't appear to be going anywhere. They got some young, great legs on that team. They should be in the mix for a third one next year, no question about it.
Last question from me before we let you run. Travis Dermott has agreed to a 2-year contract with the Leafs. The AAV is $1.5 million. Good bit of business for the Leafs?
Well, they've got some options for sure, and we don't know where it's going to play out for Travis, whether or not he still ends up protected or not, and where Seattle is on Dermott. But, you know, you've invested a lot of time in these players, and I think, you know, they certainly look at him as an asset, and if they find a way to maybe move him, it's a lot easier for teams to also trade for him if they know where his contract lies, you know, in the next year or two. So, yeah, I don't mind the signing at all. You know, at times I think he could have played more, been in a better position to advance, you know, his development, but a couple of hiccups here and there. But I think a serviceable player. We'll see where the Leafs are. I think there's some talk now that they may have interest in Rick Tocchet coming in behind the bench. So I think, you know, adding his experience would probably help a team that doesn't have too much, you know, in terms of the pedigree of a Stanley Cup around them. I think he could help. But they've got some work to do this offseason, no question.
Nick, we're going to let you scoot. Appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much.
Okay, Jeff, have a great day.
You too. That's Nick Kypreos, Director of Hockey Operations for Line Movement. You can follow him on Twitter at Real Kipper. Of course, the NHL season is over. The Tampa Bay Lightning 1-0 winners over the Montreal Canadiens in Game 5. And it just smothered the Habs. And congratulations to Julien Brisebois, John Cooper, and the Lightning. They are a model organization in a salary cap league. And yes. Kipper said there is that whole thing with Kucherov and the salary cap, and you can have that debate forever, but never criticize an organization that takes advantage of its opportunities. It's the same thing as people who hammer on the Leafs because the Leafs can spend money outside the cap. It's, you know, if somebody's willing to fork over money to put together a defending team, to put together a championship team, if he gets buy-in from his players, if they get buy-in from their players, pardon me, to me it's all fair. And again, kudos to the Tampa Bay Lightning. The Euro final is set. It'll be Italy and England. From Wembley Stadium, England advancing yesterday with a controversial win over Denmark. I think on balance, the right team won. I'm just not certain that the penalty that ultimately told the difference in the game. I don't know whether or not you can defend it as a penalty. I don't think it was, but I would have felt a lot better if the referee had used everything, all the tools at his disposal to reach that decision and gone over to the sideline and checked the replay himself, not just taking the advice from VAR, but going over and checking the replay himself, I think it would have made a difference to the outcome. It also would very much have been in keeping with what we'd seen through this tournament. VAR and the officiating in this tournament has been really good, and it's kind of a shame that In one telling moment, a lot of good was undone. Martin Tyler is Euro 2020 play-by-play announcer. He'll join us in a few minutes. We'll talk about England. We'll talk about Italy. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. right. Well, it's not going to change the outcome of the game at all. But I don't even. You can file this under the thanks but no thanks department, I guess. But UEFA, the governing body of European soccer, has, quote, charged England after a laser pointer was shown in the face of Denmark goalkeeper Kasper Schmeichel as he was about to face Harry Kane, what would turn out to be the deciding goal in Wednesday's 2020 Euro final. England will also be, or has also been charged with the booing of the Danish anthem and the lighting of fireworks inside the stadium. And like me, I'm sure you're saying, okay, what does that mean? Well, censure generally can mean a very nasty piece of paper sent in your direction. Or in 2008, Lyon, a French team, they were fined $5,000 for what were called incidents of an unsporting nature after a fan aimed a laser pen at Cristiano Ronaldo during a Champions League game. So I know there are people out there who are going to look at that, look at those incidents. They're going to look at the disputed penalty call leading up to it. And look, I'm certainly not one to carry water for English soccer. You know that my allegiances generally lie with, for personal reasons, with Germany. It's where I spent part of my life. But this shouldn't take away from the fact that I think on balance last night, England were the better team than Denmark. And I understand that the better team doesn't always win. But I think if you watch that game or follow the game or watched it again, as I did, you know, when I got home, it's God love the Danes. They're the best story of the tournament. They're still going to be the best story of the tournament after Italy and England have played on Sunday. But my sense is the two right teams are meeting in the final. I want to bring in Martin Tyler, one of the voices of Euro 2020. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your patience. I mean, I think I'm right in summing it up that way. Denmark is going to be the best story of this tournament. And I know I walked through the and I don't know if you necessarily, it was a controversial penalty. I think the manner in which it was dealt with made it more controversial than anything. But by and large, I think we're seeing the two, I think we're seeing the two best teams in the final, aren't we?
Yes. A short answer, yes. I agree with you. And England did deserve to win the game over the piece. Of course, the incidents you've referred to, you're quite right, as a committed journalist to bring those into the discussion. But whether Denmark's the biggest story in this country, I'd be surprised. That everybody is great sympathy. Christian Eriksen played in English football for a good while. We're talking much loved as a player and as a person. But, of course, the story here is the England getting to the first final since 1966 in the major tournament, the first time ever in a European championship. And, locking horns with Italy. I've been lucky enough to broadcast most of the games for both the countries, and I think they are the two, certainly Italy, I think, the most watchable team. I really admire the way Roberto Mancini set them up, and contrary to maybe the natural Italian psyche or the psyche of Italian football, they've really been a gung-ho team, and they've mostly, although I thought they were probably the second best team in the semi-final, their semi-final, but they got through, they've mostly overpowered the opposition and done it in a very pleasing way for football lovers. So I think it's the right final. I think it'll be a great final. And, we're all really looking forward to it. I will be broadcasting it, and I promise there'll be plenty of Italians listening to this, I'm sure, that there are two teams on the field, and I'll make sure that I treat both equally.
It's interesting you mentioned the, sort of this different Italian team, the joy with which it seems that they play. As someone who follows the Premier League a lot and consumes a lot of, a lot of English media through podcasts or through newspapers or through TV, one of the things that has stood out to me about this English team, leaving aside the style of play and leaving aside, just the skill level of this team, there seems to have been, there's always attempts to create drama around an England team. Sometimes the players are their own worst enemies. I haven't seen that this year. And I'm wondering if maybe, I think it might have been, I don't know if it was Ian Wright who talked about how one of the differences between this English team and other English teams is it's not as cliquey. You don't have sort of the Manchester United group against the Arsenal group, against the Chelsea group. And, because there was such a rivalry between managers like Arsene Wenger and Sir Alex Ferguson and maybe Jose Mourinho, that tended to carry over into the national camp. Is that a legitimate point of view, that there's less of that sort of inter-club tension?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's also legitimate to say that about the Italian group as well. I was fascinated right before the tournament started that I was to be involved in Italy's group matches, that Leo Bonucci came out and said that we're all really together. It hasn't always been that way. It was quite an admission from somebody who played over 100 times for his country. And I think it's true in any workplace. We've all been in different workplaces. Sometimes the chemistry is there. Everybody gels and it basically is a pleasure to go to work. It wasn't always a pleasure for those outside those cliques that you mentioned to go and play for England. And that's quite sad. Former England players have quite freely admitted that. But that has changed. It's down to, I think, a change in the culture as well, but also to Gareth Southgate's astute management, who's recognised that. And the squad is spread across, because they're big squads now with 26 players, spread across a wide spectrum of clubs. So there are individual pals. Mason Mount and Declan Rice grew up together at Chelsea's academy. Then Declan was let go and ended up at West Ham there. It's a bromance, really, between those two. And there are others that obviously spend more time with each other. But the general collective is excellent and not a word. And you're right in what you said about stuff escaping from these previous camps and maybe souring the whole journey. It hasn't been like that, and that's a credit to all involved.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, too, if maybe in an odd sort of way social media hasn't helped that, because, you watch, for example, Marcus Rashford sends out a tweet, big upping the guys after he hasn't played in the match. That would pretty much prevent any rumors of Marcus Rashford is unhappy because he's not playing, escaping from the camp. And I've kind of wondered if maybe that, oddly enough, social media, which is the bane of a lot of our existence, and I would argue certainly has poisoned a lot of the discourse in society. I think in some ways it may have actually helped here, because it's kind of alleviated some of those storylines, right?
Well, there's a lot of good in social media. I'm not on it, and I don't feel the need to be on it, and I'm sure people aren't interested in what I've had for breakfast, but it's porridge, if you want to know. And I think it does play a part in the world of much younger people than me, and I respect that right and the freedom to interact and get closer perhaps to your heroes. But obviously, like many things in the world, a minority spoils it for the majority. And the players have become much more savvy about it. It's probably monitored more closely from within the England setup and at the clubs. There was a weekend where all the Premier League teams, I'm sure you remember, all the Premier League teams said, we're not putting out any social media for the whole weekend to try and make the point, look, come and play fair with us. Don't three or four really, really obnoxious tweets can sour it for all those who've been saying nice things about people. So it is part of our world. I don't think we can envisage a change, certainly not in my time, I don't think. But you were mentioning Marcus Rashford. I was thinking Jack Grealish, came on, is very much the fans' favourite, has played a bit, has always done well when he's played, but hasn't cemented a starting berth. And then to make sure of the victory, he had to be substituted in Gareth Southgate's mind. Mm-hmm. And he was celebrating as wildly as anybody at the end. He realised that the greater good is better than his own personal ambition. And that's the way they are. I think it's the watchable Italy be the likeable England in the final.
Right.
You know, it's gone that way, and that probably is contrary. And you've made a good case from the English point of view, and I've tried to make a case from the Italian point of view. It's contrary to what has gone on before, and it shows they're in the final. They haven't been, you know, bored with each other, not liking each other, sulking off with each other. You know, they haven't. They've gone with it, and they realise that they're within touching distance of history. England have never won the European Championship, never been to a final. Italy have only won it once, despite all the other honours that they've won in the game. They've won more than England by a distance. So, right people, right place. I think Wembley's a wonderful place for the final to be staged. The atmosphere last night and indeed on Tuesday night with a smaller crowd was just sensational. And well done to UEFA, who somehow made this tournament with all the difficulties that were there before the pandemic, you know, the spread across the continent, the different venues. They lost one venue out of 12, which I think was an amazing achievement. And we've got here, we've got to this point where we've had 50 games out of 51, and the 51st should be well worth waiting for.
Now, you've, as you pointed out, you've called matches for both teams. Would you expect to see any wrinkles from either manager going into this match, or will we see basically the same lineups, and the same substitution patterns?
Well, Gareth Southgate did change for Germany, and he went from the back four to the three, which he finished with in the game last night to just be secure. And obviously, Denmark were down and out by then, so the security was probably achieved with a little bit more ease than maybe they thought when they made that change. So that would be one question, whether England will decide that three at the back against a team that has got attacking power would be the better way to go. I have no insight on that. That'll be Gareth's call. And I don't see Italy, if they might change a little bit of personnel. Immobile has not played very well in the last two games, but he's still a real personality player, a player who you feel won't flinch from the demands of the final. So there might be a little bit of tinkering in the attack with Mancini, but he's got plenty of options, and he's managed the whole thing superbly. They both have. One's going to win and one's going to lose, but they both come out of this tournament with massive credit because they've seen the values, the way they played. They've seen the values of the people, the humanitarian side of getting the guys through all this. Which is very glamorous, but also is very, very hard work and sacrifices, particularly with the bubbles that they're in. Obviously, the protective COVID situations that make it very difficult to interact with friends and family. But maybe that's improved the focus. The focus has certainly been there for both of them, and they do both deserve to be in the final.
Martin, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much. Have a great call. And again, thank you for your time. Stay safe. Stay well.
Same to you. And anytime you want to call, I'll pick up the phone.
Take care. Thanks for that. That's Martin Tyler, Euro 2020, one of the Euro 2020 voices. And he will have the call on Sunday. And I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that the two best teams are in the tournament. And it has been fun watching. Watching the Italian team, I just find their, and I'm not one of those people that necessarily rails against defensive soccer. I think you do what you have to do to win. And at the end of the day, I think winning a title, winning the Euro, winning anything justifies the means. It's nice if you can play sexy, wide open, free flowing football, but I'd rather have a win. I'd rather have the title. I'm not necessarily interested in brownie points, but man, it sure helps when you've got a team like Italy with that defensive DNA, but with such a deep midfield and just such a sense of, like I said, there's such a sense of pleasure in watching them go about their business that you don't often see. Should be a hell of a final on Sunday, to say the least. The NBA final started. Game two goes tonight. The Phoenix Suns are up 1-0. How will the Milwaukee Bucks slow down Phoenix's backcourt? How will they slow down Chris Paul and Devin Booker? Is this series going to turn on Jrue Holiday and his ability to write himself large all over the series? Mitch Lawrence will join us to discuss that next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Game two of the NBA Finals. We'll go tonight. The Phoenix Suns grabbing a 1-0 lead in the series with a 118-105 win in game one. And, predictably, I think, given the storylines going into the series, this really does seem to have become Chris Paul's postseason. I mean, he seems to be the dominant story, and he and Devin Booker, again, a going concern in game one. I would expect that they would be a going concern in game two. The guy that I have kind of felt to be the key to this series, giving Giannis his due as one of the best players in the game. But the guy that I felt would turn out to be the key of this series going into it was Jrue Holiday. I didn't see enough out of him in game one, and I didn't see enough out of him to change my opinion that while it won't all be a one-man show, I don't think these things ever are, Jrue Holiday has to, I think, be the best player on the court for the Bucks, or the very worst, the second best player in the court for the Bucks, for them to have a chance at all in this series. Mitch Lawrence is a host on SiriusXM NBA Radio, and he joins us in Writer's Block. Mitch, as always, thank you for doing this. You know we appreciate your time. I mean, I'm not going to hang it on one guy, but I think if you're going to slow down that backcourt, I think a lot of it's going to fall on Jrue Holiday's shoulders, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And, game one, what happened? Phoenix hunted out certain situations where Jrue Holiday was not on Chris Paul. Chris Paul was working against, off switches, Brooke Lopez, Connaughton, Bobby Portis. That was a total mismatch. Phoenix did a great job in their film study knowing how they get the Bucks in certain situations where they're going to have the advantage. And the disappointing thing to me was that Mike Budenholzer just didn't have Jrue Holiday on Chris Paul the whole time, fighting over screens, staying with him, and not switching. That's what we wanted to see, because Jrue Holiday is an excellent defensive player. And for Chris Paul, it was like easy. And it was too easy for the Suns the whole game. There was nothing. I never sat there watching the game. I don't know about you. I never sat there watching a game going, boy, you know what? Milwaukee is really turning the screws on them, and it's hard for Phoenix to figure out what to do. Phoenix figured out everything offensively and always had the upper hand, and Milwaukee never slowed them down to me one time. And this is Booker going, 1 of 8 from three. Chris Paul, second half, he commanded everything. He orchestrated everything perfectly against a defense that was basically, it blew up in Milwaukee's face. To be able to switch things so that you're going to have Brooke Lopez trying to guard Chris Paul is inane.
Yeah, and it just seemed as if it just seemed as if there was all the switching Milwaukee was doing. I mean, I guess there's two ways to attack a team like Phoenix, but it just seemed to me that more often than not, that all I saw was kind of was Brooke Lopez, God love him, just kind of out there on his own, And oh, meanwhile, God. you've got the best pick, one of the best pick and roll teams in the NBA doing its thing, and yeah. Brooke Lopez is kind of standing there like, guys, give me some help here.
And honestly, it was really, I mean, look, I understand, quick turnaround from Milwaukee, not a lot of time to prepare. Phoenix had a lot more time to prepare for them, but even still, you got to know going into that series that you cannot afford to have your bigs out on an island against Chris Paul because it's going to get ugly. And that's what it was, because Chris Paul right now, the way he's shooting the ball, and not just orchestrating the offense, and by the way, the thing you got to love about him is not just that he makes the right plays, finds people open, he doesn't turn the ball over at all, but his shooting has been just outrageous. The way he's closed out series against, you know, the Clippers, and then before that Denver, he's really got a hot hand going. And to me, Mike Budenholzer, the big mistake was not having Drew Holiday somehow on him at all times. It kind of reminded me of a different way, a less of a way, but it reminded me of 96 finals. You know, Gary Payton wanted to play Michael Jordan. We all thought that Gary Payton should be on Michael Jordan, but for some reason, George Karl didn't, for the first part of the series, have Gary Payton on Michael Jordan. And they went down 0-3. And of course, they never recovered, made it closer. But, you know, when you have a premier defensive guard, you want to really attack their best player who's a guard with that player. And to me, Drew Holiday was not on Chris Paul nearly enough. I am sure we'll see him a lot more on Chris Paul tonight.
What'd you make of Giannis's game? And what needs to be different in game two? Or does anything need to be different in game two from him?
I was stunned he was out there. I really was. Because when he got hurt in that game against Atlanta, and then he missed the last couple of games, the way he came down, you know, it was a collision with Capella. I figured he was done for the playoffs, done for the finals. Maybe you'll see him late in the finals. So I was really, I mean, boy, the recovery aspect was just astounding to me and good for him. He, you know, did he impose his will? Did you ever sit there thinking, did he ever take the game over? No, he never did.
No.
He needs to take games over. He needs to be, you know, the problem with Giannis is he's a two-time back-to-back regular season MVP, one of 12, I think, in the history league, maybe 13. Yet in the playoffs, he struggles to do things. He struggles to find his shot. He struggles to shoot free throws. He struggles with his command of the game and his feel for the game. And he puts up unbelievable stats doing all that because he's still so gifted. He in this series, he has to be, to me, he has to be the best player on the floor for the Bucks to win games. Now, I don't know if he can do that on that knee. He looked pretty good. You know, don't get me wrong, just how the knee was. But there's still, to me, the problem with him against a good team, and all you're seeing now, you know, in the playoffs, obviously, it's down to good teams. Teams know how to defend him. And there's some points where you just scratch your head. And this is about the Bucks too, of like, it always comes down to one question when they're struggling offensively. What are they doing? Why are they doing this? Why aren't they attacking the paint? Why is Giannis doing this? What? You know, they haven't figured it out. That's what we're finding out. Their team, like all the other teams that were in the Final Four, Clippers, Phoenix, and Atlanta, they had never won titles. And these teams that don't win titles, they have to figure things out, how to win championships. And sometimes it looks okay, and sometimes it looks pretty ugly. And for the Bucks, and by the way, I don't know if you noticed this, but in the last 14 games, Phoenix is 12-2 in their last 14, ever since they went down 2-1 to Lakers. In that same game frame, time frame, the Bucks are 8-6. So one team, to me, is playing at a much higher level, even though they were kind of close regular season record-wise. Suns right now are the far superior team. They are playing like a championship team. They are playing like they know what they have to do, and a lot of it has to do with Chris Paul. Meanwhile, the Bucks are still kind of like finding their way, and it drives you nuts because, as Charles Barkley says time and again on TV, they're dumb. Yeah, there's a lot where it looks like the Bucks are dumb. The Suns are never dumb, are they? The Suns know what to do, spreading the court, putting the ball in the hands of the right people, and it goes back to your original point about this is the Chris Paul.
How much of it as well is Monty Williams and what he has been able to do? You know, look, he's a very popular guy in the NBA community. A lot of people, obviously, the backstory and everything, they're really happy for him. But he also seems to be the perfect coach for this group. You know, I'm just watching some of his interactions with guys like Jay Crowder, who I love, by the way. But even his interactions with guys like Jay Crowder, he just seems to be the right guy for this group of human beings, you know?
Yeah, I'm not around the team, so this is from afar. But first of all, and this is nothing against Monty Williams, but when you have a guy on the floor like Chris Paul, that makes coaching a lot easier. Because Chris Paul is going to figure stuff out on the fly, and he doesn't have to be told. As a coach, you don't have to tell Chris Paul what to do. And there are times, I think, in the last game where Monty Williams said, it was before the game or whatever, saying, you guys, you know, go out and play the way you're supposed to, the way you know how to play. But Monty Williams obviously has had a big impact on the fortunes of that team. You know, Devin Booker, I think Monty Williams is like his fifth coach in 6 years or something ridiculous. You know, the thing about Phoenix is that, you know, before this year, I don't care what they did in the bubble, I don't count that. Before this year, they hadn't been in the playoffs since 2010. They had been a revolving door with the coaches. They had several people running their front office. They were poorly run by, you know, an owner who couldn't get out of his way, similar to the owner in New York, James Dolan, similar to the owner in Sacramento, Vivek Bebe, guys who meddle, guys who don't know what they're doing, guys who should stay out of the way for the most part and sometimes make the wrong hire. And, hey, James Dolan finally made the right hire in terms of Leon Rose as the team president. Why? Because Leon hired the right coach. He didn't hire Phil Jackson again to run a team when he's never done that. You know, and Sarver's had a bad track record ever since the Mike D'Antoni days, in terms of hiring the right people. So they hired the right coach. Monty Williams is great in terms of he knows how to talk to players. You know, he's a former player. He knows how to deal with these guys. But the big thing is, listen, if they didn't make the trade for Chris Paul and they had Ricky Rubio at point guard, would we even be talking about the Phoenix Suns on July 8th?
No. Not unless they were trading somebody.
The answer is they're sitting at, they're sitting at home. I'll make this argument. They would have gotten like Rondo or another, or could they have traded for Kyle Lowry? I don't know. But this is the perfect situation for them to get a guy at this stage. The only question I had about Chris Paul coming in was he going to be able to stay on the court and stay healthy? Because that's always been his problem. He's a phenomenal regular season player who in the playoffs struggles to stay on the court, stay healthy. We saw it in 2018 when he was with Houston and what they did to Golden State, and they were up 3-2 and they lost the Western Conference Finals because he blew out his hamstring. And he's a guy who, unfortunately for him, it's always been about he can't answer the bell. It's right. Wild that in this year, it's the craziest for injuries, the worst year the league's probably ever had in terms of guys who have gone down, all-star caliber. Chris Paul's the guy left standing. How crazy is that?
Mitch, we appreciate your time. Thanks so much, man.
All right, Jeff. Take care. Thank you.
Take care. That's Mitch Lawrence of Sirius XM NBA Radio. David Sampson, Ryan Callahan ahead. Lots of baseball talk, some pucks as well. Don't go anywhere. This is Writer's Block.
This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt, and Richard Deitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Major League Baseball has either or is expected to ask Major League Baseball Players Association to agree to a 7-day extension of the leave of absence that Trevor Bauer has been placed on as a result of an investigation by Pasadena Police and Major League Baseball. Surrounding accusations leveled at him of sexual assault. Of course, we have kind of a similar experience dealing with this in Toronto when it came to Roberto Osuna. But there's some things that have kind of gone on the side here in the background, if you want to call it that, I guess, that have kind of made this brought the situation in a different light. And I want to bring in David Sampson, host of Nothing Personal, the podcast. I want to bring him into the discussion. David, thank you for doing this. As always, we trust you're doing well. Should I read anything into the fact that the Dodgers, in addition to, you know, and I guess going along with the administrative leave baseball has put him in, they've removed his items from their gift shop. Jerseys, et cetera, licensed, Dodgers licensed, outlets, retail outlets have removed his, his memorabilia, if you want to call it that. And they've also canceled a Trevor Bauer bobblehead, which was a promotional night. Should we read anything into this at all?
Yes, I would hope you would, because the Dodgers are now trying to separate themselves from Bauer, and he still has at least a year left on his deal, and maybe even two if he picks up that strange third-year option. Do you remember his contract was to make him the highest-paid player in this season and next season? But then in the third year, it was a player option at $15 million, where he would likely turn it down. In the old days, when he was, in his mind, a performing player in good standing, he was going to turn that down, so he'd end up with a two-year deal with the Dodgers and then be a free agent again. Now, if no one will sign him and his contract doesn't get terminated by this investigation, he's likely to pick up that option, interestingly enough. But the Dodgers are pretty much saying, we made a mistake here signing him, and we made a mistake by saying we're going to pitch him on Sunday, July 4th, and we're now trying to cover up the mistake by pretending he wasn't even a Dodger. What I can't wait to see is whether he got edited out of the hype-up videos they show at Dodger Stadium and all of the commercials they have when they promote the Dodgers, because once you edit out a player, that really is game over.
Could we really, I obviously don't have a legal background here, so I don't know if you can void a contract for something of this nature. I just don't know. But if this thing goes as far as people seem to think it might be going, could this turn into, I'm not going to call it a test case, but could this turn into, you know, almost a nuclear showdown between a player, a team, the Players Association, and baseball?
Well, first let's talk about the world that we live in right now. Thankfully, this type of behavior is not tolerated the way it once was. The Players Association is not going to line up to defend Trevor Bauer. That's right. Why they agreed to extend the 7-day administrative leave, which they did today. So he's not going to be back on Friday tomorrow. He's not going to be back 7 days from tomorrow. They're going to continue that administrative leave until Pasadena decides whether or not they're going to charge him. And then if they don't charge him, MLB will finish its investigation, and then he'll go from this leave right into a suspension. Because I assure you, there will be a suspension, Jeff. It's not just going to be, oh, everything's okay, she was making up everything. No, he's going to get suspended. The showdown you're talking about is if the Dodgers try to void his contract under several clauses, which I would be working on right now with my lawyers. There are clauses for behavior. There are clauses for representing the best interest of the team, properly representing Major League Baseball. There's certainly clauses that if you get charged with a felony, that is cause for termination. So certainly convicted for a felony, and some contracts have just charged with the felony. So right now they're looking at his contract and his guarantee language. Can we take a minute and talk about how these contracts work, or would
absolutely.
You rather wait till next week?
No, absolutely.
So when you sign a player, every player in baseball signs what's called a uniform player contract. That has all of the boilerplate provisions, whether you're making the minimum or whether you're Trevor Bauer making the most of anyone in baseball. But then there's something called the guaranteed language, and that's different for every player. The guaranteed language is negotiated with the agent and the team, and it talks about all the things that a player can or cannot do. And we tried to make very strict guaranteed language with things that players can't do off the field, like activities, things players can't do off the field, like actions, like being involved in fights or being arrested or being charged with felonies.
Can I just jump in? Is that something that each team can put its own language in?
Exactly correct.
Okay.
So the uniform player contract is the same for every player on every team.
Okay.
But the guarantee language not only is different from team to team, it's different from player to player, depending on how the negotiation goes. So I haven't seen Trevor Bauer's contract, but I can assure you when you are paying someone $40 million a year on a two or maybe a three-year deal up to over $100 million, you are putting in provisions for behavior, for remaining in good standing both on and off the field, because you've got to protect yourself if something like this happens. And it's not as though Trevor Bauer, and I want to be careful here, Jeff, what he did prior to being a Dodger was nothing compared to what he's charged with or what he's been investigated for now. But this was not a guy with a stellar reputation. When you show up Terry Francona on the mound, and when you are so loud in your social media, when you're so offensive in some of your posts, if I'm the Dodgers, my antenna is up from the beginning, so I have very strict guaranteed language. And I'm confident the Dodgers are going to lean on that, and they're going to try to terminate his contract.
Wow. I mean, that's I would certainly think, you know, from a sort of a moralistic point of view, that would be the thing to do. But that, I guess you're right. Who's going to argue against it? The players association aren't, I guess, as long as the uniform part of the contract hasn't been tampered with or hasn't been broken. Do they have much of an argument if the guaranteed portion is? Probably not, because he signed it, right?
Yeah, you know, it's very, and not only when you sign a contract, both MLB and the Players Association approves every contract. I can't just sign a free agent to a contract and hide the contract from everybody. It has to be approved by the commissioner's office and by the Players Association. And everyone has a copy of it. There are no secrets. Everybody sees every contract. I can actually see contracts back when I was in the game. You can see the provisions of other players' contracts in a system. And the reason is when you trade for a player, it's your job. When you trade for a player, you have to see what the language is in the player's contract who you are acquiring, because you're not allowed to go to that other team from where you got the player or go to the commissioner and say, oh, my God, I didn't realize he had a player option or a vesting option. I didn't realize he had a bonus for plate appearances or games finished. It's your job to do due diligence to look at the contract of a player you're trading for. And in free agency, you can make up anything because it's a brand new contract, but it does get approved by both sides. And the Players Association, trust me, Jeff, they've got a lot of battles to fight with MLB. They are not going to fight over someone who is hitting and violently beating up women. They're just not going to do it.
How do the Dodgers handle it if the police choose not to proceed? And I think you're right. I mean, Major League Baseball will investigate it, and I would think that there would be some form of suspension. But how do the Dodgers, as an organization, pivot off this? Never mind the fact that this is small potatoes compared to, you know, to the physical abuse the woman took, but he's a pretty important part of that team. How do they pivot off of this?
Yeah, so they're going to hide behind baseball. So you have certain canned statements that are prepared by your PR people that are ready to go immediately in situations like this, and they all sound the same. We support Major League Baseball and the joint domestic violence policy, and we understand and agree that we will not tolerate violence toward women. That's the statement they do, and they will, whatever MLB does with their suspension, the Dodgers will say, we agree and we support. They're going to try to separate themselves from Trevor as much as possible. As much as we think the big bad Dodgers and, you know, Mark Walters and Stan Kasten and Andrew Freeman, they don't want to be on the wrong side of history. They don't want to be on the wrong side. You can sign a player who's not a good guy, right? Randy Johnson was not especially the nicest guy, or Barry Bonds, but we're talking about something not personality-based. We're talking about violence and physicality toward women. You don't want to stand behind that or have that person on your team representing your community. The juice is just not worth the squeeze.
Moving on from Trevor Bauer, John Heyman had a report today that the Jays may be interested in or kicking the tires on Nelson Cruz of the Minnesota Twins, the Oakland Athletics as well. We talked about this in Baseball Central, and there are ways that deal kind of makes sense for the Jays if other stuff happens. But, you know, there's also a lot of people that will look at deals and they'll go, well, if you can't beat them by pitching, you can beat them by outscoring them. So load up your lineup and go out there and win games 10-8. It's not that easy, is it, when you're sitting there and trying to decide whether you trade, like whether you trade for a hitter or a pitcher? It's not, at least I don't think it is. I don't think, given the way the game is played now, it's that easy, is it?
Yeah, I've tried that, actually, where we said our pitching staff isn't good enough. Let's try to outscore somebody every game. And that just doesn't work over a long period of time. And it really doesn't work in the playoffs where pitching is needed. Pitching is the premium. And the reason why you read all these rumors right now is that there are certain teams that are guaranteed sellers, and the Twins are one of them. Mm. And it was shockingly, actually, because I picked them to win the division. But the reality is they've got some good pieces, whether it's Berrios or whether it's Cruz, and the Twins would be smart to move them. And the Blue Jays, in their due diligence during the trade deadline, when you're in the race, and the Blue Jays are firmly in the race, only three and a half games behind the second wild card, they're not totally out of the division by any stretch. So they're definitely buyers, and they should be buyers, because when you have a core like they like the Blue Jays have, you want to try to win as often as you can, especially with the Yankees having an off season. And so you call every team, and you ask about hitters, you ask about pitchers. So, of course, the Blue Jays would call on Nelson Cruz. But if they only have a certain amount of money to spend, I'd like to see them spend it on pitching, not hitting. While I do love the fact that the Blue Jays, I think, are ranked sixth in ERA and third in average in the American League, you can never have enough pitching. And Mark knows that. There's no question about it. So I'd be surprised if they go with a bat like Nelson Cruz. Of course, they could give up prospect capital and not take on money. But I think the Twins would are going to shed that money. They'll want to shed that money. And I don't think the Blue Jays should spend money on Cruz. They should spend money on pitching.
Dave, one of the things that intrigues me about a team like the Twins, and I'm with you. I thought that the Twins were going to be much better. I thought that it would be the Twins and the White Sox fighting it out for that division. But when you have a team like the Twins that has had such a bad year, and you are sitting there and you're saying, all right, let's try to get rid of some of these salaries. Let's try to bring in players that can help us for the future. How hard is it to make sure that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, and that you don't get to the point where we're going to throw, okay, this guy, move him out. This guy, move him out. Like, it's got to be, there has to be almost a psychological break, isn't there, where you're thinking, let's not do too much, because I've got to think that it would be easy for a team to say, yeah, send him, send him, send him, send him. And I'm just wondering how difficult it is for a club to make sure that they don't, you know, you don't give away the family jewels in addition to the silverware when you're getting rid of guys.
So every team and every executive does what I did. I carried around with me everywhere I went. It started with a piece of paper, actually, but as technology improved, it was on my phone, a 1, 3, and 5 year payroll. And what that means is I had every player on our roster, and then I had who we were going to keep the next year, and then we would advance their salaries if they were going into arbitration or if they were free agents who got a natural raise as part of their deal. We would know who we could have on the team and who we couldn't going forward. And there'd be some open slots where we'd put free agent pitcher and we'd have budgeted $7 million for, let's say, or $8 million, whatever the case is. So the Twins know right now who's going to be with them next year and who's not. And if you're going to trade someone who you had planned to be on your team next year, that's when you demand an overpay. Mm-hmm. When you're trading someone like Cruz, who's likely not going to be on your team, then you're just trying to shed the money and get back some prospects if possible. But someone like Berrios, who you would say, yeah, he's going to be on our team next year, you'll still trade him, but you have to be completely bowled over. And I don't think the Jays, where they are, should overpay for anybody, because while I think they're in a competitive position, while I think they have a really good team, their window is not one and done this season. They've right. got a multi-year window. And when you're in the beginning of a multi-year window, the last thing you want to do is overpay for a player.
Do you believe it when you hear a team say he's off the market? You know, like the Colorado Rockies have said, we're not trading Herman Marquez. He's off the market. Do you believe that?
Marquez would have to be the first player in history who's not ever going to be traded, right? And it's right. possible. Maybe Bud Black, maybe they identified the only player in the history of Major League Baseball who will never be traded no matter what. So I can't answer to that. I can only tell you that we would never say statements like that. Because why set yourself up to lie, especially in this day and age when people can go back and see every soundbite you've ever done over the last 20 years? What our line was, and we taught our GMs to say it as well, is that everybody is open to be traded and available to be traded, but some are less likely than others.
I just found it so odd coming from an organization that is just still getting raked over the coals for how it dealt with Nolan Arenado. I there are some organizations, I swear to God, there's a culture of stupidity that sits in around them.
Think about it.
And to me, it's the Rockies.
But think about it. They're hosting the All-Star game. He's their only All-Star, although Trevor Story is going to be there in the home run derby. So all they were trying to do was a PR move and say, hey, don't worry, we're not going to trade him. What they really should have said is, we can't wait for Marquez to represent the Rockies at the All-Star game. That's all I would have said, because I, too, would not trade a player, even, let's say in 2017, when the Marlins were hosting the All-Star game, we weren't going to trade any of the All-Stars. Even if we were going to trade them and we were not in the race and we were going to not go for it, we wouldn't have traded anyone right before a home All-Star game where a player, one of our All-Stars, no chance. But after the All-Star game or during this offseason, I think the Rockies are silly not to trade Marquez. He's their most valuable trade asset. It's not Trevor Story. He's going to be a free agent at the end of this year. The most valuable asset is someone who is signed to a long-term, semi-reasonable deal. And if you are looking to rebuild, although the Rockies never rebuild, I don't know what they do, but if they were going to rebuild, he's the exact type of person you do trade.
Very quickly, before we let you run, we are now into the second week of the sticky substance police. Pitchers seem to be stripping less now. They seem to be just, handing over their gloves and their hats and going about their business. Are you surprised that sort of the drama around this just seems to have kind of stopped? You know, the whole Max Scherzer thing and then Sergio Romo. Now it seems as if everybody's moved on.
So don't you know that every time there's change, right? When there's a new website designed for your favorite website and you go on it and you can't navigate it and you're so angry and pissed off because you can't find anything, and then 10 days later you can't even remember what the old website looked like? That happens in sports, or really in business, when you change a policy, like a human resources policy. No more sitting at the lunchroom on the left side. On the beginning of that, you'd be upset because that's where you eat, and then you forget about it. Players were up in arms, and I still disagree with what MLB did. They shouldn't have changed at the middle of the season, but eventually you move on to the next thing. And that's why when you have a PR problem, the best thing to do is just own it, and then move on from it, because there's going to be another crisis right around the corner that's going to take the attention away. And that's what players are doing in foreign substances. They're moving on to the next thing.
David, good stuff as always. We appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Take care. Thanks, Jeff.
David Sampson's former MLB executive. He's host of Nothing Personal, the podcast at CBS Sports HQ. You can follow him on Twitter at David P. Sampson. Ryan Callahan. He's an NHL Network analyst, former NHL forward as well. The Tampa Bay Lightning wrapped up the Stanley Cup 4-1, a 1-0 win over Montreal last night, a conclusive 1-0 win, just smothered the Habs. And as a result, the Tampa Bay Lightning have won back-to-back Stanley Cups, a rarity in a salary cap era. It's a team that has some decisions to make moving forward. Their head coach, John Cooper, talked about that yesterday. But I don't think anybody, let alone Leafs fans who must now live with the possibility of moving back into a division with the Lightning, I don't think anybody's anticipating the Lightning will go away anytime soon. Ryan Callahan joins us next. This is Writer's Block. Reminder, we will have Blue Jays baseball for you tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet, as the Jays wrap up a 3-game series against the Baltimore Orioles. Alec Manoah on the mound for the Jays. Dylan Tate will be on the mound for the Orioles as they go with an opener. The Jays will then go on to face the Tampa Bay Rays, and that will conclude the pre-All-Star break portion of their schedule. Those games, of course, will be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You can hear the games only on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and of course, watch them only on Sportsnet. The Tampa Bay Lightning wrapped up the Stanley Cup last night, their second consecutive Stanley Cup, with a 1-0 win over the Montreal Canadiens. And I think I used the word smothered to describe what the Lightning did to the Canadiens. The Canadiens' one win in that series was an overtime. And, you know, you look at the Lightning and obviously the discussion point. People are going to be talking about Andre Vasilevsky, clearly, and Kucherov and Stamkos and, you know, the elite players on this team. But my goodness, I look at the bottom couple of lines, and if you look at the last six goals the Lightning scored in the playoffs, they were all from, you know, the Tyler Johnsons, the Blake Colemans. They were from, I'm going to call them their depth players, but I'm not using that term as a pejorative. It really was remarkable. Not just the top end talent, not just the amount of top end talent the Lightning have, but the depth. And I will admit, you know, like a lot of us, I was watching the North Division more closely than any others, watching the Lightning, saw them play the Islanders. I thought, boy, the Lightning are a good team, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. I had no idea. Honest to God, I had no idea how deep they are. Ryan Callahan is a former NHL forward. He's a current NHL Network analyst. He joins us on Writer's Block. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm putting my hand up because I knew about all the elite talent on the Lightning. We knew the fact that, you know, their John Cooper had said to people, hey, this could kind of be our last kick of the can as a group. But honest to God, I had no idea how effective their depth was. And that really, I think, came through in that series. Everybody talks about having depth, but when your depth can score goals and do a bunch of other stuff, you've really got to figure it out, don't you?
Yeah, you do. I appreciate you having me on and listening to you there. I think you nailed it. It comes down to their depth, and that's what made them so effective. I mean, a lot of times you get in these playoff series and, you know, top lines kind of cancel each other out, and, you know they're both playing well and checked hard, but it comes down to your depth players coming up big, and especially the Yanni Gord, Coleman, Gaudreau line. I mean, that line just stands out to me, not only this year, but last year as well in the playoffs, is a line that you put out there in any situation against, you know, another team's top line as a shutdown line, an energy line. They started every single period, basically throughout these whole playoffs. And then could chip in and put the puck in the net. And then you also talk about, you know, Coleman and Gaudreau, how good they were on the penalty kill together and how many offensive chances they created throughout the playoffs on the penalty kill. So that line to me just sticks out so much in why they had so much success and why they've gone and won two back-to-back Stanley Cups.
How much of it as well do you think comes from the fact that they have been together for so long? Like, you know, like, God love the Montreal Canadiens, but they added a bunch of veteran players. They brought in some new guys this year. They went on a run in the playoffs, but man, you looked at the Lightning. I think Steven Stamkos said that, you know, we kind of looked around the room and thought, guys, this could be our last period that we play together as a group. And then, and as I said, you look at that and you go, this team really does have it figured out.
Yeah, I think you, as you said, I mean, I was there for a lot of those years too, as they were kind of figuring it out, going through their playoffs, obviously in 2015, we would go to the Stanley Cup Finals with Chicago, two conference finals after that. So it's that core there that has been together for so long. And, you know, Kucherov, Stamkos, Hedman, Palat, Johnson, you go down the list of those guys, Killorn, that have been together for so long and have built a culture there that, you know, there's a way they handle themselves, and they knew their talent and they knew how good they were. And then you bring in guys like Coleman and Gaudreau, and they just plug right into that. You know, you're just around the team and you can sense that there's that character there, and there's a way they go about their business, and, you know, that's contagious. And they have it there. You know, and it seems like last year when they won, it just kind of all came together for them. They kind of got over that hurdle, you know, of losing a couple of years there being close. They get over that hurdle, and then all of a sudden going into this year, you just have that swagger to them. You can tell. I mean, they didn't seem like they were too worried about where they finished in the standings. Just making the playoff was their main goal. And then once they got into the playoffs, they, they showed why they're the defending cup champions and how good they are. And I just like the culture they've built there over the past 6-7 years has come to fruition and really showed their dominance over these last 2 years.
How much of that culture comes from ownership? Like, and clearly Julian Brisebois gets credit for it, and Steve Yzerman, I guess, as well before him. But how much of that culture comes from ownership and also from John Cooper? Or is it more a collective thing?
No, it starts at the top. I think you're correct in saying that. It comes from Jeff Vinnick. Since he took over the team, what they've done there and building that culture, that winning mentality. And he's a world-class owner. He'll do anything for you that you need, anything the team wants. Obviously, they spend to the cap. But just how he is and even how he handles himself throughout that Tampa Bay community and how much he gives back and how much he means to that community, all of that trickles down throughout the team. Then, as you mentioned, Steve Yzerman kind of started this whole thing and turning this team around, and then Julian Brisebois jumps in and takes over and makes some unbelievable signings and key trades to get over the hump. And then John Cooper, who is I look at as part of this core, right? He's part of these guys' core and these guys' makeup. A lot of them, these guys started with him in the AHL where they won together. You know, Johnson and Palat, Kucherov, guys like that have been with Cooper for quite some time. I mean, their entire career. So, you know, what he does and how he handles himself is embedded in those guys as well. So it's fully throughout, but it definitely starts with the ownership, Jeff Vinnick, and how he is. And, I mean, a quick story, I mean, just to give you an idea, when I got traded from the New York Rangers and over to the Tampa Bay Lightning, one of the first people to call me was Jeff Vinnick, and then welcomed me to the team, welcomed me to the organization, where you don't see a ton of that. Obviously, maybe an owner would call a little bit later or you'd bump into him, but he made a point to give me a call and make sure I felt comfortable and said, anything you need or anything you want, just don't hesitate to ask me. So just shows his character and how he runs a team.
Ryan, we talked about the importance of the depth players. We talked about the importance of Blake Coleman and Barkley Goodrow. Look, understanding that there's a bunch of stuff that's going to happen this year with the expansion draft and all of that, but that's, you know, 2/3 of a pretty good line, a line that really gave this team a lot of energy. They can become unrestricted free agents, I think, in July 28th. How do you think Julian Brisebois manages this situation going forward?
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not in his shoes, I guess, is the easy answer. I mean, there's a lot of decisions you have to be made. Obviously, with the Kucherov situation coming back, they're well over the cap, so that has to be corrected next year. And specifically that line, as you mentioned, I think it's probably going to be tough to keep both of them. I think there'll maybe be a little bit more of a market out there for a guy like Coleman, who I think has a little bit more of an offensive upside. Brings a little bit more. So I suspect they'll try to get both of them back. But, you know, if I'm sitting here and I'm guessing and looking at that team, you know, I think Gaudreau would probably become at a better price point for them than Coleman, as they're going to have to pinch some pennies here and try to stretch a dollar as far as they can, because they're going to be right there tight against the cap.
It helps, doesn't it, as well, when your goalie is 26 years old and you've got him signed for 7 more years. Was there ever any doubt in your mind that Andre Vasilevsky was going to be this good?
I knew he was going to be good right from day one. This good, I don't know about that.
I guess that's pretty hard.
That's hard, yeah. I mean, I didn't predict him to be, you know, best goalie in the world, up to the win a Vezina up for 2 more and everything else, but you could tell right away that he was going to be good. Obviously, when he came in, we had Ben Bishop in net, who was an absolute stud himself. So he kind of learned from Bish and kind of sat behind him for a couple of years, but you could just see Vassie in his work ethic. I mean, you talk about guys' work ethic all the time, but you literally had to drag this guy out of the rink at night. He was the first one there. How dedicated he was to the game, that really showed right from day one. And then obviously going against him in practice and seeing him in games, you could just see his talent and how good he was. And I think the main factor for me was in that 2015 finals, this young kid rookie gets thrown in the net because Bish got hurt and has to play a game, and he played unbelievable for us. You know, so for a young kid in that, at that position to be able to step in a stage like that and have the performance he did, you can tell that he wasn't going to be fazed by any situation, and he was going to be ready, and he was ready to take the next step in the NHL.
How much of the Lightning, you know, the success their defensemen have at both ends of the ice owe to him? Like, they seem very you're going to be very comfortable playing in front of a guy who's the best goalie in the world, but it just seems as if there's something natural there. You know, you watch the way the defense play off him. You watch sort of you just get the sense that everybody understands everybody else's second nature, and that's got to make it easy for defensemen, or easier at least.
Yeah, it is, and it absolutely makes it easy. And those guys have been together for quite some time now, you know, many years, you know, 5-6 years, that defensive core has been together for that long as well. So there just comes a familiarity. You know what guys are going to be, you know what the goalie's going to do when he gets the puck. You know, and playing in front of a guy like that, I was lucky enough to play in front of Lundqvist and obviously Bishop and Vasilevsky. It does. It puts it in the back of your head that, hey, if I make a mistake here, you know, this guy's probably going to stop the puck and have my back. So it just calms your nerves a little bit, right? You're not afraid to make that, maybe that seam pass or that pass that's a little risky, because, you know, you got a guy in net that 9 times out of 10 is going to come up with a big save for you.
Now, you talked about how when you were with the Lightning, you know, obviously there's a period of growth for this team. They didn't just fall, you know, get plopped down into Tampa Bay and start winning Stanley Cups right away. What's going to be the key to Montreal to build on what they did in these playoffs from your experience? Like, how do you go about learning from losing in a final or going on that great run?
Yeah, I think this is a great learning experience for them, and something that core of that team, I think, can really build off of. And I mean, it kind of similar to how in 2015 we lost in the finals to Chicago Blackhawks game, and a lot of those guys that we're talking about now were very young players and just getting into the league and learning the league. You can see that they have a good core there. I think Montreal has to obviously make some moves around it to build around that core. I'm not sure their core is as strong as Tampa's was at that time, but you got some nice young pieces there, I think, to build around. And this experience of going to the Cup final, I'm telling you, you can't buy that. You know, so this is a very valuable learning lesson for them, and a valuable, very, very valuable experience to be able to go to the Cup final and go through the ups and downs of a playoff series and have that in your back pocket next time you're there.
Ryan, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much, man.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks for having me on. Enjoy the off season now.
Take care. We will. That's Ryan Callahan. Not as much as the Lightning, though, is my guess. Ryan Callahan, former NHL forward, current NHL Network analyst. And lessons for Montreal, of course, you know, from a guy who's made it to the Stanley Cup final. And it's, you know, they always say, I think it was Mike Bossy, when we had Mike Bossy on earlier in the Stanley Cup, was talking about the learning you do from losing. I think he said, I think his line was actually, you learn to win by losing. Of course, great coming from a guy who's a multiple Stanley Cup winner and one of the greatest snipers of our generation. But I do really think there is something there is something to it. And I think the question is, if you are the Montreal Canadiens, if you look at the totality of what we've seen from the group that got together in the bubble last year to the group that made it to the final, there has to be, I think, a sense, an awareness that progress was made. And yeah, they finished fourth. You know, they were not the best team in the North, but they were able to figure some things out along the way. My only concern for Montreal, and look, I'm not close enough to the team to know how individual players are going to react to individual situations. My one concern for that team would be Kasperi Kotkaniemi, and how does he respond to what is effectively a benching? And there's no other way to put it. I mean, you can say it was done for strategic reasons, whatever, but the fact of the matter is it was effectively a benching. And he's a guy, frankly, that Dominic Ducharme has to have with him next year. And if you're Montreal, again, I'm assuming or presuming you're going to remove the interim tag from Dominic Ducharme and make him the head coach and make him the head coach of your team. But the only way you learn from losing like that, and Ryan talked about it, is you've got to ensure you got to keep that group together. Right, you got to keep that core together so that all the guys who went through that learning experience can feed off each other. It's the same thing we talked about with teams winning as a group or core players winning multiple championships, how enjoyable it is, just how much it matters to be able to look across the room at a guy and go, yeah, I want to ring with that guy. You know, it may not... who knows, that horrible night where you're playing in Columbus and it's January and you're down 3-0 after the first period and everything sucks, and you look around the room, you go, got a ring with him, got two rings with him. I really do believe that from talking to enough athletes, that type of stuff matters. It's not always the fact that a guy gets up in the middle of the room and makes a speech. It's the fact that a bunch of players can look around and realize that they've all walked the walk before. No one has to talk to talk. They've all walked the walk before. They've won. You see that with Tampa Bay, and that's going to be important for Montreal. So for me, for Montreal, job one is to make sure that they don't lose Kasperi Kotkaniemi as a result of this, because you can talk about losing being a learning experience. That only works if you keep your group together, and when guys get a chance to sit back, they're doing it and looking at what they accomplished from a positive point of view. So I think, to me, that's job one for Montreal. Of course, obviously, there's the expansion draft and the Seattle Kraken and all that stuff, but that's job one for Montreal. Again, if you're a Leafs fan, we should have taken calls today and just asked Leafs fans, okay, the Lightning have won back-to-back Stanley Cups. The Habs are in the final. The Bruins are the Bruins. Ottawa's improving. Florida's Florida. I'll leave aside Buffalo for now. What are you feeling about next year? What are you feeling about the division next year when it all gets back together? I know you're right. We got plenty of time to think about that. We're going to take a break and come back and get you set for Tim and Friends. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We will have Blue Jays baseball for you tonight. The weather holds. 7 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, as Alec Manoah will take the mound for the Blue Jays against Dylan Tate. And the Orioles will be using a bullpen day. And then it's off to Tampa for three games against the Tampa Bay Rays. Three games that will lead the Blue Jays into the All-Star break, and three games that I think will begin to tell the tale of the 2021 season. They will lead into games against Boston, against the Mets, not so much the Mets or the Texas Rangers, but mainly Boston. And that'll tell your tale going up to the trade deadline. You'll have an idea at that point. One, where the Blue Jays are, and two, how they will proceed at the trade deadline. It's just interesting how it's all kind of dovetailed this year. And of course, the trade deadline could also be, although I'm led to believe the chances of this are thin, but it could also be the date around which the Blue Jays return to Toronto to play at the Rogers Centre. So needless to say, this is going to be an intriguing next 3 weeks for the Toronto Blue Jays. There's a run of games that is going to tell us what 2021 is all about. And I'm not going to say that at the end of the day they'll be out of it necessarily. There's always a chance. There's always a chance to go on a run. But it will take less of a run if the Blue Jays can go in a bit of a roll right now. And they will attempt to do that, as I mentioned tonight, the third of three games against the Baltimore Orioles. Stay tuned to Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. If there is any inclement weather in the Baltimore area, we will let you know. But right now the game is going to go as scheduled, 7 o'clock, first pitch on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. Just ahead on Tim and Friends, Arden Zwelling of Sportsnet will join Tim to discuss the Blue Jays. Kelly Rudy from Hockey Night in Canada in the NHL on Sportsnet to discuss the Tampa Bay Lightning Stanley Cup win over the Montreal Canadiens. And Dominic Moore, former NHLer, will be along as well. So there'll be a lot of baseball talk ahead, a lot of hockey talk ahead. There's no hockey tonight in the tube. There's basketball. And as far as we know right now, baseball. So that is it for us. Kevin Barker and myself will be back tomorrow from 2 to 3 for Baseball Central. I'll be back solo one more time. Promise. It'll be the last time on Friday. Enjoy your night.